Todd had picked up a viola. Jenny had a less than full-sized violin. Fletch spoke over the scrapings and plunks. "Did you catch him?"
"Who?"
Flynn poured a cup for Elizabeth as well. "The arsonist."
"Oh, yes," said Flynn.
"Was it the gas station attendant?"
"It was a 43-year-old baker."
"Not the gas station attendant?"
"No."
"Oh. Are you crushed?"
"Why was he burning down Charlestown?"
Flynn shrugged.
"Jesus told him to, or so he said."
"But where did he get all the Astro gasoline containers?"
"He'd been saving up."
Elizabeth was tuning his cello.
"Now, let's see what this is all about."
Leaving his cup drained behind him, Flynn sat behind his music stand.
"Elizabeth usually joins us at the piano," he explained to Fletch, "but Beethoven didn't consider her today."
She came over to the divan and took her tea. The children were behind their music stands. The youngest, Winnie, was the page-turner.
"Remember to turn to me first," his father said. "I've got a memory like a bear's mouth."
They all straightened their backs, like flowers rising on their stems in the morning sun.
"Con brio!"
their father shouted, in a voice of pleasant threat. They were off, bows indicating two dimensions in their coming and going, eyes intent upon the sheet music, Randy's violin gracefully indicating, belatedly, a few notes Jenny skipped, her blue eyes getting more huge as they traveled down the page, a few times losing her place altogether. When she had nothing to play, she sighed, then her tongue would sneak out and touch the tip of her nose. Winnie back and forth behind them like a waiter, following his father's score, turning his page first, then Jenny's on perfect time, frequently a help to her finding her place and a cause of renewed, more confident playing. Then Todd's, then Randy's. Every 5 or 6 minutes a jet screeching by just 500 meters above the house, deafening the players. Drowned out, they soared away apparently soundlessly, making them adjust their paces to each other once they could hear each other again, ever and always Flynn's cello playing along, leading from behind.
"Molto, molto!"
he shouted over the shrieking of a jet during the third section. He was enormous, delicate over his instrument. Keeping the pace, somewhat, the tone, as well as it could be kept. Elizabeth sitting in the divan beside Fletch, ankles crossed, hands in her lap, loving them all with her eyes. Upstairs, a baby mewed. They sat rigid in their slight curve, shoulders straight, chins tucked, the boys' blue denim stretched over their slim thighs, sneakers angled on the floor like frogs' feet, the sky through the windows behind them going down the scale of gray through dusk to dark, more lights coming on at the airport across the reflecting surface of the harbor. During the fourth section, Jenny was tired and not as practiced. Sighs became more frequent. The tongue crept out to the tip of her nose even when she should have been playing. Even Randy's and Todd's faces shone with perspiration. Their hair matted on their foreheads identically. For a moment, Fletch looked at the chessmen set up on a board to his right. A game was in progress. Jenny was vigorous in the last bars, practiced, allegro, and finished a little before the others. She looked momentarily confused. It was a wonderful 40 minutes.
"Bravo,"
Elizabeth said while she and Fletch applauded.
"Pretty good, Jenny," Randy said, standing up.
Without comment, Flynn closed his sheet music and stood to lean his cello in the curve of the piano again.
"Da,"
Todd said. "That should never have been in anything other than F major."
"We all make mistakes," said Flynn, "even Beethoven. We all have our temporary madnesses."
Elizabeth was hugging Jenny and complimenting Winnie on his page turning. It was 5:20.
"I expect we could find a drink for you before supper," Flynn said.
"Elizabeth drinks sherry, and I suppose there's some other stuff in the house."
"I have to get to the airport," Fletch said.
"Oh," said Flynn, "skipping town, finally?" Conversation was suspended while a jet thundered overhead. The room reeked with accomplishment as the kids moved about with their instruments. They bounced on the balls of their sneakered feet as only happy, accomplished children do.
"Andy's arriving," Fletch said finally.
6:30.
"Is she now? That's nice."
"You'll stay for supper,"
Elizabeth said, coming back to where Fletch was now standing.
"He's picking up his girlfriend," rolled Flynn, "at the airport. That will alarm your police escort, I'm sure. I'd better warn them you don't mean to take flight, or they will tackle you at the information counter.
They'll watch you all the same.
Bring her back with you, Elizabeth said.
Fletch shook hands respectfully with the children.
I like you, Elizabeth said. Franny, this is no murderer.
That's what all the women say, Flynn said. I haven't convinced him yet either.
His face was good while he listened.
As long as he didn't hum along, Flynn said, tap his toes. They all laughed at Flynn as a jet whined in a holding pattern over their heads.
Bring your girl back with you, shouted Elizabeth. We'll wait supper for you.
Thanks anyway, said Fletch. Really, this has been a wonderful time for me.
Flynn said,
we'd be glad to have you, Fletch.
Fletch said, I'd be glad to stay. May I come back sometime?
What's your instrument? Winnie asked.
The typewriter.
Percussion, said Flynn.
Well, said Elizabeth, Leroy Anderson wrote for the typewriter.
You come back any time, said Flynn. Any time you're free, that is.
In the cold vestibule, Flynn said,
I guess you didn't have the conversation with me this afternoon you wanted to.
No, said Fletch, this was much better.
I thought you'd think so.
May I see you in your office tomorrow?
Sure.
What's a good time?
5 o'clock. Any policeman with good sense is in his office at that time. The traffic is terrible.
Okay, where are you?
99 Craigie Lane. If you get lost, ask the plainclothesman following you.
They said good night. Outside, the air was damp and cold.
Fletch stood on the top step of the porch for a moment, adjusting his eyes to the dark, feeling the house's warmth at his back, hearing a bit of early Beethoven scraping in his memory's ears, thinking of the two blue doll's eyes under a doll's mop of tossed curly blonde hair. Across the street, under a street light, he clearly saw the faces of the two plainclothesmen waiting for him. It seemed to him their eyes were filled with hatred. One of them picked up the car phone as Fletch started down the steps. Flynn would be telling them Fletcher was going to the airport and they shouldn't panic, but to make sure he didn't get on a plane.
Jesus Christ, Fletch said.
The scrape of his chin on his shirt collar made him realize he should have shaved.
Chapter 30.
Fletch!
He had never seen Andy in an overcoat before. After they had embraced and he had taken her hand luggage, her first question was quick and to the point.
Is Sylvia here?
Yes.
Bitch, what is she doing?
I don't know. I haven't seen much of her. I mean, I haven't seen her often.
Where is she staying?
At my apartment.
Where am I staying?
At my apartment.
Oh, my God.
How are you? Andy's big suitcase was in the way of people coming through the customs gate. The few porters were being grabbed by artful older people.
Any luck with the paintings?
She asked.
Can we wait till we get in the car? How are you?
He handed her back her purse and vanity case.
Why did you want to know about Bart Connors?
How are you? He carried the huge suitcase through the airport, across a street, up a flight of stairs, across a bridge, and halfway through the garage to where his car was parked. The plainclothesmen, hands in their pockets, followed at 20 paces. She began her questions again as he drove down the dark ramp of the airport garage.
Where are the paintings? Do you know?
Not really. It's possible they're in Texas.
Texas?
You and I may fly down later this week.
How can they be in Texas?
Her aunt seems to have gotten all 3 Degrassi paintings from a man in Dallas named James Cooney. He's a rancher with 8 kids.
Do you think so?
How do I know? I've handled her aunt very carefully. His reputation is impeccable. Pompous bastard, but everything he said so far has been straight. I'm putting a lot of pressure on him to try to crack Cooney's source.
You mean find out where Cooney got the paintings?
Yes. If putting pressure on her aunt doesn't work, then we go to Texas and put pressure on Cooney ourselves.
What did you do? You asked her aunt to locate one of the paintings?
Yes, the bigger Picasso.
Where is that painting now?
In Boston. Her aunt has it. I asked him for it Wednesday. He located it Thursday night or Friday morning and had it flown up Friday night. I saw it Saturday. He doubted the whole thing when I first spoke to him about it.
What do you mean?
Well, he doubted whether the painting existed, whether it could be located, if it was authentic, if it was for sale.
Is the painting authentic?
Yes, I'm as certain as I can be. So's her aunt. And apparently Cooney is willing to sell it. After paying a toll, they went down a ramp into a tunnel. Fletch spoke loudly at Andy's puzzled expression. So far, Horan has acted in a thoroughly professional, efficient, routine manner. I don't like him, but that's immaterial. Driving up out of the tunnel, they faced strata of crossroads and a vast confusion of signs and arrows. "Oops," he said, "I don't know which way to go." "To the right," Andy said. "Go on Storo Drive." "How do you know?" He turned right from the left lane. "We're going to Beacon Street, aren't we, near the gardens?" "Yeah, but how do you know?" They went up a ramp onto a highway. "I lived here nearly a year," she said, "the year I was at Radcliffe." "Where's that?" "Cambridge. Go down there to the right to Storo Drive. You knew that." Her directions were perfect. "Why did you want to know about Bart Connors?" she asked. "Because the night I arrived, a girl was found murdered in his apartment." Her profile was backed by lights reflected on the Charles River. "He didn't do it," she said.
"You seem pretty certain."
"Yes, I am.
That's why I yelled at you that night on the phone to get out of the villa. When I asked you to go see him, I did not expect you to take up residence with him."
"You'll want to go left here." At the red light, she craned her head left. "We'll have to go all the way around the gardens, won't we? Dear old Boston. Or is your apartment down to the right?"
Fletch said, "The police think I did it."
"Murdered the girl? You didn't do it either. If you did, you wouldn't be trying to blame Bart."
"Thanks.
Bart's a very gentle man. Wouldn't hurt a fly."
"Boy, when I asked you to do a job for me, did you check his teeth, too?"
"His teeth," she said, "are perfectly adequate."
"My God."
"So who killed her?"
"Damn it, Andy, there's a very good chance Bart Connors did."
"No chance whatsoever."
"He was in Boston that night when he wasn't supposed to be. He was seen two blocks away from the apartment in a pub with a girl tentatively identified as the murdered girl just before she was murdered. He had a key to his own apartment. He left on an airplane from Montreal just after the murder, and within the last 6 months he has received a sexual psychological trauma delivered by a woman which he considered wrongly a blow to his masculinity."
"I know," Andy said. "He told me all about that."
"Great."
"And he told me the night you called you were trying to lay the crime off on him. He asked more questions about you than you've asked about him."
"Andy,
watch out for that taxi. Furthermore, Fletch," she continued, "I can testify that the sexual psychological trauma delivered by a woman, as you phrase it, has done him no harm whatsoever."
"I bet you can."
"You and I have our understandings," she said. "Stop being stuffy."
"Stuffy? You're wearing my engagement ring."
"I know, and it's a very nice ring. Whom did you make it with this week?"
"Whom? What?"
"I didn't hear your answer. You're not acting like Fletch."
"We need a place to park."
"Over there to the left."
"I need two places to park."
Headlights grew large in his rearview mirror.
"Absolutely," she said. "I will not help you blame Bart Connors for a crime neither of you committed."
He said, "Such loyalty." Going up in the creaky elevator, she said, "Try Horan again."
Chapter 31. On the sixth floor landing, Fletch put the huge suitcase down to take his keys out again to unlock the door. Sylvia, arms wide in an apron, opened the door. Andy and Sylvia clutched and jabbered simultaneously in Italian. He had to insinuate himself with the luggage through the crowded front door. They sounded like a girls' school reunion. He understood Sylvia had prepared a magnificent supper for them, a dinner. He left the luggage in the hall and walked empty-handed down the corridor to the telephone in the master bedroom. Even through the closed door, he could hear their delighted shrieks and exclamations while he dialed. "Mr. Horan, this is Peter Fletcher."
"Ah, yes, Mr. Fletcher.
Sorry to phone on a Sunday night."
"Quite all right. I'm used to calls from anywhere at any time. Have you decided to change your offer for the Picasso?"
"Have you spoken with Mr. Cooney?"
"Yes, I did.
He said he won't respond to your offer at all."
"He wouldn't consider it?"
"No."
"Was he any more open regarding the painting's provenance?"
"No, I said you rightfully had questions. I outlined to him quite carefully what you had said regarding your responsibility to question the provenance. I went as far as I could, short of physically shaking him, which would be difficult over the phone anyway."
"And he got nowhere?"
"He didn't even deign to offer the usual evasions. He said the authenticity of the painting can't really be questioned."
"Of course it can."
"Not really. I have thoroughly satisfied myself. No, he's prepared to stand on the painting's authenticity."
"I see."
And by the way, Mr. Fletcher, our Texas cowboy friend rather surprised me by repeating something you said.
Oh?
He referred to Vino Viola Mademoiselle as a most significant Picasso. He referred to it as the key work of the Cubist period.
Oh.
So our cowboy with eight kiddies has no sheep wool over his eyes, if I may coin a phrase.
If you insist, Mr. Horan, offer Mr. Cooney $527,000 for the painting.
Ah, Mr. Fletcher, now you're in the arena. I most certainly will.
And you may remember originally I said I might ask you to help me on another problem or two?
Yes.
I wonder if you would ask Mr. Cooney if he has another particular painting in his possession.
You mean another specific painting? I don't understand.
Yes, another specific painting, an Umberto Boccione, entitled Red Space.
Red Space? Again, you've got me stumped.
Mr. Fletcher, you go from a key Cubist work by Picasso to the work of an only relatively important Italian futurist.
I know.
Fire and water.
Or water and fire, depending upon your point of view.
Well, again, professionally, I have to advise you that I don't know if such a painting exists.
I do.
What makes you think Mr. Cooney might have such a painting, Mr. Fletcher?
We all have our little secrets.
You mean you want me to ask him straight out if he has this red space by Boccione?
Not necessarily straight out. After all, I'm offering over $500,000 for the Picasso.
It's worth much more.
I think it's a good enough offer to justify a little conversation. You might say that someone has mentioned the existence of such a painting and you'd give anything to be able to locate it.
You want me to exercise craft, is that it?
Even deviousness, suggested Fletch. I'll be interested in what he says.
It's nearly 8 o'clock now, Horan said. Of course, that's not Dallas time. I guess I can try to call him tonight.
Will you call me in the morning?
If I reach him.
Thank you. Good night.
Chapter 32. The dining room table had been set with crystal and silver. The light was subdued.
Oh, it's nothing, said Sylvia, removing her apron. I'll serve.
Fletch sat at the far end of the table. Before leaving the room, Sylvia indicated Andy should sit to his right. Sylvia would sit at the other end of the table. Fletch said to Andy, trust you don't feel 7 years old.
What's going on here?
Oh, said Fletch, soup.
The first course, said Sylvia. A nice soup.
In the flat bowls was about a cupful of consommé. The bouillon cube, worn away only at its edges, sat in an island of its own grease, surrounded by cool water.
I can tell, said Fletch. You gave us big spoons.
Applying the tip of the spoon to the bouillon cube accomplished nothing. A minute Michelangelo with hammer and chisel might make something of it. Stirring the water around the cube only caused it to sway like a tango dancer. The grease reached out in disgusting finger-like patterns. Sylvia said,
I thought we all needed a good hot dinner. Feeling untasty. American cooking, yes?
Fletch said, yes.
After such a long airplane ride for poor dear Angela.
Yes.
This beastly cold New England weather.
Yes.
Good hot American cooked soup.
Most substantial, said Fletch. Full body, vigorous aroma, the ambience of a bus.
Juno, like your soup?
Sylvia had come to collect his bowl.
Juno, finish your soup.
It's taking too long to cool down.
He waved it away. While Sylvia was in the kitchen, Andy said,
She can't cook. Everyone knows that.
I'm finding it out.
Now the fish,
Sylvia announced from the door.
Good American fish.
A piece of cold canned tuna fish and a quarter of a lemon lay on this plate. What happened to the fourth slice of lemon?
Oh, yeah, said Fletch. Fish. I recognize it. Glad you removed the head, Sylvia. Never could stand a fish head on a plate. Aren't you glad she removed the head, Andy?
I'm glad she removed the lid.
That too, said Fletch. Funny no one's ever made a solid silver can opener to go with a place setting. I think there'd be a market for it.
At the end of the table, Sylvia was beaming. Her neckline disappeared into her lap. Her bilateral upper structural support systems were more sophisticated than anything used on the Swiss railway system. It was not the same gagging decolletage she had worn to stun the Ritz.
Yeah, Fletch chewed the fish. This is nice.
Just like a family, said Sylvia.
Precisely, said Fletch.
Just like a family, we're all together.
Precisely like a family, precisely.
If only Menti were here.
Now, there was a man who knew a piece of fish when he saw one.
Poor Menti.
Nice touch, the slice of lemon, Fletch said. Did you cut it yourself?
They've located the body, Andy said.
Whose? Sylvia said.
What?
In a pasture, outside Turin. The police called just before I left.
Sylvia said,
They found Menti?
Really?
Sorry, Andy said. I didn't mean to bring it up at dinner.
You can't ruin dinner, Fletch said.
Sylvia began in galloping Italian exclamations. At one point she blessed herself with her fork, ultimately giving way to long questions, which Andy answered tersely. As Sylvia's questions became shorter, she switched to French, the language of reason. Andy, who had attended school in Switzerland, answered even more tersely in the language of reason. Muttering in Portuguese, Sylvia took the fish plates into the kitchen.
Now it's my turn, said Fletch.
The police called just before I left. They found the body in a shallow grave in a pasture outside Turin.
Do they know it's your father?
His age, his height, his weight, they're pretty sure. Dead about 3 weeks.
I see.
Sylvia entered with salad plates. The salad consisted of a clump of cold canned peas huddled together against the rim. On none of the plates had any of the peas broken free of the clump.
Oh, said Fletch, a pea.
Salad,
Sylvia screwed herself into a chair.
Good American salad.
She had added salt, too much salt.
I would think, Fletch spoke quietly, that if that were the case, one of you, if not both, should be in Italy to receive the remains.
Remains?
Asked Sylvia.
What's remains?
Fletch said, sort of like supper.
Andy answered her properly in Italian.
Quickly, Sylvia said,
This is not to be spoken of at dinner.
I thought not, said Fletch.
Angela,
the Countess demanded archly,
why'd you not stay to accept your father's remains?
The police want them.
Why do police want the remains of Menti?
Sylvia was getting a remarkable amount of chewing out of her pea.
They said they had much to do.
What to do? What to do with the remains of Menti?
They have to test his teeth.
What's wrong with Menti's teeth? He's dead. No good testing them now.
Fletch said, That's how they confirm the identification of a corpse, Sylvia. The body's been in the ground 3 weeks.
Oh, if the body is wearing Menti's teeth, then they know it is Menti?
Yes.
Ha,
said Sylvia, for some reason victoriously, fork in air.
Menti had no teeth.
What?
All Menti's teeth false. His gums were entirely, how'd you say, barras.
That's right, said Andy. I had forgotten that.
They can identify a corpse by its false teeth, Fletch said.
How come you know so much?
Sylvia asked.
Andy said, The police said they would give us a closed coffin when they are through doing what they can to identify Father. We can have a burial. It doesn't matter when. We've already had the funeral.
This is terrible,
said Sylvia.
Poor Menti.
Something was sizzling in the kitchen, suggesting the threat of a fourth course. Did you have a chance to speak to the lawyers? Fletch asked Andy.
Yes, I called Mr. Rosselli. He said it was good news.
That your father was murdered?
We knew he was murdered. The police said so.
Sorry.
He said the will could be read after he gets the papers from the police.
What papers? Exploded Sylvia. Already we have had papers up the asses.
They have to have positive identification, Sylvia, Fletch said. They can't settle an estate without a corpse.
Posh!
She shook her fork in the air.
All they want is Menti's teeth. You look in that closed coffin. There will be no teeth. Some police inspector in Turin will wear them.
Fletch said, Sylvia, something is burning.
Ooh,
she said, grabbing up her gown for the run to the kitchen. In their momentary privacy, Fletch said to Andy, I guess I'm tired. She said, That's why we're having such a nice dinner. I should have planned something.
Yes, you should have.
I never guessed Sylvia would make such an effort. Andy said,
I don't guess she has.
The entree was a burned frankfurter each, sliced lengthwise. At the edge of each plate was a tomato, obviously hand-squeezed. The indentations of four fingers and a thumb were clear. In fact, Sylvia's thumbprint was clear.
Oh, my God, Pledge said.
What's the matter?
Sylvia was screwing herself into a chair again.
Good American meal. Hot dog. Ketchup.
Andy said,
Sylvia, really?
You live in America, you get used to American food,
Sylvia said.
I've been here nearly 1 week already, see?
We see, said Fletch.
Bastard Rosselli say what the Mentees will say about my paintings.
Fletch said, what paintings? There are no paintings.
There are paintings.
In her insistence, Sylvia leaned so far forward she almost dipped one in the ketchup.
My paintings you to find. If Juno look for, why you here? If Juno find, why Angela come? Eh? Answer me that, Mr. Flesh-ass pants.
Fletch said, we just came for dinner.
Rosselli said nothing about the will, Sylvia.
Fletch said, I'm in love with Jennifer Flynn. He made no approach to his frankfurter and tomato. They sat there, burned and thumbprinted like a victim and a perpetrator. Andy, using her knife and fork on the frankfurter, was looking at him. He said, I would think you'd both want to be in Rome now.
No, said Sylvia. I stay here, where my paintings are.
Looking at Sylvia, Fletch counted the number of hours of sleep he had had. Then he counted the number of hours of sleep he hadn't had. Sylvia, he said, the paintings are in Texas.
Texas?
Andy and I are planning to fly to Dallas the end of this week.
Good. Then I go too.
Good, said Fletch. We'll all go, just like a family. Andy's look could have burned through telephone books. To Andy, he said, I doubt you've ever had a Texan chili. Good American cooking.
Chili sauce, said Sylvia. Do you want chili sauce?
Fletch placed his unused napkin next to his untouched plate. Sorry, I can't stay to help out with the dishes. I'm going to sleep now.
Sleep?
Sylvia was prepared to be hurt.
Juno want dessert?
Don't even tell me what it is, Fletch said. I'll dream on it. He went into a guest room, locked the door, stripped, and crawled between the sheets. The rhythms of exclamations in Italian, French, Portuguese, and English through the thick walls lulled him to hungry sleep. Chapter 33.
Hi, babe.
In the single bed, he had rolled onto his side. Light was pouring through the open drapes. Eyes open, staring at him, her head faced him on the pillow. The white sheet over her upper arm perfected her smooth, tanned shoulder, neck, throat. His right hand went along her left breast, under her arm, down her side. She pulled her right leg up to touch his. Nice to feel you again, he said. She must have entered through the bathroom from the other guest room. He flicked her lips with his tongue. Then his left arm went under her and found the small of her back and brought her closer to him.
Where were you last night?
She asked.
When? 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock? You weren't in bed.
I went out for a walk, he said, after that heavy dinner.